Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
No, you can't ask me anything. But the job here is I ask you questions, not the other way around. The Land League was set up
for anybody else.
The Land League was set up around 1871 to deal with tenants who were being ripped off by landlords. They had no fixture of tenancy. Yeah. No, there were
Vincent, you,
people
you
living.
Vincent, you weren't in Bunclody last week. You wouldn't have come to Bunclody.
Jerry,
you wouldn't come
Jerry,
to
would you please stop?
So you were out in
Jerry,
today
Jerry,
to make a scene.
Jerry, would you just shut up for a moment?
So come to the next eviction.
Would you please
come
just
to the next eviction,
just, would you just please just shut up?
If you're asking the question, Vincent, do you want an answer now or do you just want to harangue me?
Maybe if you tell us what you recall
saying. Well, if I get an opportunity to answer, I want to take it. Thank you.
You had the tapes, our independent newspapers had the tapes for quite a while before you published them.
For a while.
But can you tell us how long?
No.
Why not?
Why should I?
Because I'm asking you. And I'm sure the...
We've had them for a while, Vincent. We were using the time within which to actually gather information about this, about the significance of them and so on and so forth, and get photographs.
That's fine, but I'm just asking you, how long? You don't have to sell us the exact number of days, but all right, okay. Like, if politicians behave like that, we don't use...
Vincent, you spend so much time showing your bias towards independent newspapers, it's getting sickening at this point.
All right.
Can you not just acknowledge it's a good story and move on? Is that too much for you, is it?
Of course it is a good story.
There you go, that's just a few examples of Vincent Brown's soft, soapy, ingratiating interview style. James Dempsey has been having a look at him, given that his final show airs tonight on TV3. Were you a fan, James, of this?
So I'm not, you know, a hugely political person. So, I mean, I would only have ever seen kind of after the fact Vincent Brown when something had made big headlines the day after.
Yeah.
And then I would be watching after the fact, because I probably wouldn't be staying up till 11 o'clock at night to watch TV3 every night of the week. But I am sorry to see the show go, because I do think it kind of represents quite an interesting piece in Irish television history in terms of the legitimising of TV3 as a network. Like, it almost helped add this political force and weight and current affairs interest that the channel was really lacking for the first 10 years, I guess, of its existence, because it's been on since 2007. So it's 10 years running this year. And it has been really a mainstay of, you would say, Crisis Ireland. You know, it sort of has gone hand in hand with that. And I don't know, you know, as we sort of casually step out of crisis into the great
whatever
unknown.
This is, yeah.
Is it, we are at a loss not having Vincent asking his very, you know, direct and grumpy questions. But as a show, you know, I watched it last night and it was probably the first episode of it that I'd watched in 2017, at least. And I was kind of struck at it, you know, I'm not a political commentator, but I'm a televisual commentator. So
yes.
I decided to look at it specifically with that lens, to sort of look at it as a piece of television. And there's something really endearingly amateur about it. It just seems entirely thrown together about 40 minutes before. I mean, even last night they were saying, you know, there was obviously this big, much heralded interview with Leo Varadkar, but it opened with, you know, basically Vincent saying, I gave you those sheets, have you got the sheets there in front of you? You know, and I found that there is something charming about it. It's also very frustrating, because they're about 5 minutes in when they go, okay, now we have a break. They just seem to constantly be taking commercial breaks all the time. And that interrupts the flow of the discourse. And they seem to be just about getting to something. And look, I know this is a commercial station and we are driven by that. But it seemed just to be coming so quickly and so often throughout the hour that it was frustrating.
Yeah, in fairness now, and it's because there's been much talk about him on various stations over the years, because most hacks in Dublin will have had some contact with him at some point or another. Vincent Brown would not be the easiest person to work with.
Right.
Let's put it that. So I wouldn't blame the production staff and the programme, but he's the world's worst TV presenter.
I mean, apart from
being brilliant journalist, awful TV presenter.
Oh, rubbish.
He's stuttering, he won't read the auto cue. And obviously he's got an earpiece and he's just ignoring them. And it's almost like he goes against the medium. He doesn't want to be slick. And I don't know if it was deliberate or not, or just sort of
his
a crankiness
rate,
on his part. But it's almost like he does it deliberately.
I can see exactly where you're coming from. And he even, Right, what more can I add, you know, to every, what everybody knows? I can't really add much more. But I was again struck by those faces he makes, you know, when he sort of, he flits between just absolute impassivity to this kind of real cheeky grin, to kind of a manic gurning. It is, it's incredible to watch the sort of dexterity of his face, if you can say that. And yeah, I do think it's going to be a loss for TV3 in the sense of, you know, they probably will replace it, I guess, with something. But for 10 years, the show has existed as a very biting and controversial and, you know, polemicizing, if that's a word, piece of Irish current affairs programming that you just don't see on RTE. And if it exists on TG Car, I don't know either. But that kind of just really occasionally aggressive and belligerent interviewing, you just don't see on RTE.
No, you just don't see it. Having said that, I think it fulfilled different functions on different nights. Now, the face thing that you're like, you know, if he'd have a panel of politicians, he'll ask them a question that any politician will say, that's impossible to answer. I can't give you a definitive yes or no answer on that, because either A, I don't know, or if I say yes or no, I'll get in trouble with my party, or we haven't made up our mind yet, or we don't have the, you know, and none of the things politicians like to say. So he immediately backs them into a corner. They start bullshitting, and then he starts doing the kind of thing. Now, it doesn't actually further the political process, but for the people watching, for the diehard Vincent Brown fans, it gives them a kind of an emotional satisfaction to see a politician being tortured. But it doesn't actually achieve anything.
Well, and you got that as well last night, even particularly. I mean, right, so Leo is not the most charismatic politician out there, but what he is very sort of, he's very determined to have charisma. And he works very...
Wow, talking about damning with faint praise.
And he works very hard, obviously with, you know, PR people to affect this kind of... I think he's going for a kind of everyman type vibe that he just really can't pull off, right?
Yeah.
And it was interesting to watch him, you know, sort of muddle headfirst into this comment about the middle class and what percentage of middle class and who's middle class and who earns that and all that. and Vincent clearly went on for even longer than was necessary. But yes, he was just, you know, pounding him into submission.
Yeah. But there actually, there were other nights where, say, he'd have a panel of journalists now. No, there was a clip, an example we played there, but he wouldn't be antagonistic to them. But there are nights where, say, he'd have panels of journalists, so and it'd be really, really informative stuff. You'd get all sorts of information about various issues you wouldn't read anywhere, because they were kind of having a chat among themselves. So on some nights it was extraordinary in terms of just pure journalism. Yeah. And other nights it was just circus, really. And but people probably enjoyed the circus more than anything else.
Very much so. But again, it's also a show presented by one person going out four nights a week for an hour, driven by the issues of the day, which is a very tight turnaround in terms of producing that and formatting it with a difficult to work with host and an ever-changing political narrative. I mean, it was
grueling.
It was grueling. Yeah. So, you know, a fair play for it for lasting 10 years, first and foremost. And come what may, we'll see what comes next out of that 11 p.m. slot. But the other thing that I was actually really struck by when watching it was... that the scheduling in TV3 is really odd, because, you know, you have this interview with the Taoiseach coming on at 11 o'clock. And this, I think, I could be wrong, but this, my understanding was this was the first Taoiseach to appear on Time with Vince.
Yeah, because Endo never would.
And it was going to be about, you know, the stretched middle class and centrist politics and all that. And the hour before, the programme that was on was something like Britain's Biggest Spenders. And it was a 2006 ITV just absolute puff nonsense about these people rolling up massive debts. Somebody bought a town in Bulgaria, buying this giant village in, or giant villa in somewhere like in Malaga or Marbella or somewhere, and just was completely at odds with what was following after it. So I find that's what I find almost bizarrely charming about the whole TV3 production is that you just get such nonsense mixed with politics, mixed with random rubbish all in a row.
A few comments on Vincent Brown. Imagine Vinny had been given the Late Late, even for 1 week. Just imagine. He did. They did give him some sort of... They tried to give him...
Yes,
I remember
they gave him a Friday night show with Jedward.
That was brilliant. My favourite memory of Vincent Brown was the live show he put on the George on the day of the marriage referendum results. Everyone was hammered. It was so loud you couldn't hear poor old Vincent. But I thought it was pure genius that he was there in the first place. RTE would never do that. Yeah, I can remember that. It was utterly chaotic, but you kind of... I suppose what was important was the kind of vibe in the room what anyone was saying. He's the best thing on TV. So sad he's going. How will we get our Vincent hit now? Well, I don't know. Well, he's not going out to pasture. I'm sure he'll have many other projects on the go. He is apparently writing a book about Charlie Haughey. That'd be really interesting. I used to watch it as an entertainment show, Comedy Gold, and I think a lot of people did. Well, not as an entertainment show, but, you know, the fun of... to see if a politician would blow a gasket. Though someone else says, Vincent Brown makes no attempt to be impartial or balanced. He imposes his own hard left outlook on the show. It's like listening to Radio Moscow. Not lately. If you got into a time machine and listened to Radio Moscow maybe 40 years ago, it might be that. Though it is interesting that, whereas perhaps a lot of men that reach a certain age that become more right-wing, he probably became more left-wing. But, you know, he's... I think in his defence, when he says he's not impartial or balanced, he's on the side of people who've been screwed by the system. And so he's probably cheerfully not impartial on that particular issue. But then who of us would be? Anyway, we'll move on to a few bits of TV news. Mel and Sue are back together. Now, this is a non-Bake Off show, yeah. Obviously. What are they going to be doing?
So since Bake Off will be moving to Channel 4 next year, Mel and Sue very famously in their joint statement said they weren't going to take the dough. Mm. They weren't going to go to Channel 4. And now they have been announced by the BBC as the new presenters of a newly revamped The Generation Game. So get ready for cuddly toys and conveyor belts. And they seem like actually a really perfect fit for that because people like them, first of all. And they are sort of very good at interacting with British people of all ages, as we've seen on when it comes to Bake Off and the contestants. And they've been together for, you know, 20 something years at this point. They started off on Late Lunch or Light Lunch on Channel 4, a daytime variety show. And they've hitched their, you know, their wagon, we'll say, to the BBC and the BBC are running with them. So I think it'll be interesting. The Generation Game has been off the air since 2002 when it ended with Jim Davidson as a presenter.
That's a different era.
Very much a different era. But it started in 1971. So it has been running on and off since then and back at some point later this year.
Do you think Mel works by herself? I know she does that choir show, but is she? Because I was watching a bit of it last weekend, and my sister said, she's annoying. And I was thinking, is it you're annoying by yourself that kind of balance each other out?
I think Sue does more things by herself. She does travelogues, and she did actually, there was a very good Desert Island Discs recently with Sue Perkins as well, worth seeking out, talking a lot about their professional relationship together is very good. But I think Mel is has a family, so she just works slightly less.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. That's the, and True Detective, of course, we all knew this was, it is returning despite the disastrous second series.
So we were led to believe it wasn't returning for a very long time because the second season came along with Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn and Rachel, one of the Canadian Rachel, whose surname now ellipses me. Yeah. But it's coming back for a third season and HBO announced this at the Television Critics Association thing, which is this ongoing event that goes on until well into August, where they basically announce TV news every single day. All the networks come forward to reveal what's going on. And the HBO guy is a man named something Blois. Casey Blois is his name. He announced that it was coming back, saying that Nick Pizzolatto, who had written the first two seasons, had written five amazing scripts and that they have cast Mahershala Ali, who people would know from Midnight, which he won the Oscar for the Best Supporting Actor Oscar. This year for that. So he's going to be the lead role. They're now shopping for a director because the first season was directed by one guy, a man named Kari Fukunaga, and he apparently had big on-set turmoil with the writer, Nick, and therefore didn't return. And the second season, HBO has now held up its hand and said it was their fault because they said they rushed Nick into writing too quickly and the material wasn't ready for their production schedule.
Mm. Okay, well, we shall see. Okay, we do have to take a commercial break to the bone after this.
You know what I'm doing. Come on.
Oh.
Yeah. All right, go. Get ready. All right, ready?
Mm-hmm.
280 for the pork, 350 for the buttered noodles, 125 for the buttered beans, 150 for the roll, and 75 for butter.
You got it.
All of it.
Yeah. Dang.
My God, it's like you have calorie Asperger's.
I mean, holy applause.
You're a pro. Okay, wait, no, so how many calories do you think boogers have?
Hey, don't say that.
What? She probably knows. You know, right?
Not just the beans, the meat.
I'd say snot's pretty low. Maybe like 5-10, depending on the size of the pickings.
There you go, that's To the Bone, streaming now on Netflix. James, dealing with very... a subject, presumably, you know, you'd have to be very careful about and
very
know your
so.
Stuff about.
And it came in for a lot of criticism as well when the trailer debuted about a month ago for this, particularly because it hadn't come with sort of a trigger warning, we'll say, which is now not an uncommon thing to happen. And if you do sit down and watch the show, it does open with a black screen with some white writing that warns you that this is, you know, sensitive material, might not be right for everyone. But you're kind of... No, if you make,
it is about a woman with an eating disorder.
It is, yeah. So, anyway, so what is interesting about when you make any kind of entertainment out of any kind of, we'll say, mental health disorder, including eating disorders in this instance, you're really stuck because all the guidelines say don't do this. So don't, for example, talk about calories and counting that we heard in the clip there. Don't show sort of images of like frail and extremely thin men or women. Don't do any of these kinds of things. Don't show the kind of activities they would do, people suffering, I should say, in order to sort of boost their weight when they're weighing in and stuff like that. And yet, when you're watching a movie, that is actually kind of that is sort of the spectacle you want to see, because you're looking at, you know, it's turning either bulimia or anorexia or any of the other myriad eating disorders into a kind of quote unquote freak show spectacle. You know, it's supposed to be really shocking and interesting because of that. So this is made by Marty Noxon. She is the writer-director. People will actually know her work actually quite well. She was a writer and executive producer and eventually the showrunner on Buffy the Vampire Slayer way back when. And then she had made the show Unreal, which is kind of about The Bachelor, which was a big hit in its first season and fell apart a bit in the second season. And her name has been attached to many big high-profile TV shows. So this is her first foray into kind of filmmaking, but as it's on Netflix, it's... a bit of a grey area. So she has based a lot of this on her own life because she suffered from anorexia when she was a young woman. And actually part of the story is directly inspired by that. She was born Martha and changed her name to Marty while going through, you know, recovery. Mm. And in this, the character is Ellen and she changes her name to Eli while going through recovery as well. And it's kind of a real double-edged sword because I did find it very well acted. And at the same time, I also found it like very kind of Hallmark movie of the month. You know, this is anorexia. She's thin and how do they cure her? They put her through radical, you know, into a radical house where she's surrounded by other cookie cutter characters straight out of like every kind of straight out of Girl Interrupted or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or, you know, and that I found frustrating. What I will say in its defense is I think it is extremely well acted, and the woman who plays Ellen is Lily Collins, daughter of Phil Collins, and with the biggest eyebrows you have ever seen in your life.
Actually, somebody texted in, the show had so much potential, but it was stereotypical, down to her attitude and eyeliner. Such a pity.
Yeah. So, I mean, the obviously she didn't lose loads and loads and loads of weight for this role, but she is small, and she herself, as well, Lily Collins, suffered from an eating disorder in her youth.
Right.
So there's a lot of pathos, I felt, at least to her performance, but... You know, to kind of put it crassly, there's just not enough meat on its bones. You know, you want it to be more than it is. You want it to be daring. It's sort of, you know, kind of pussyfooting around a bit, really. Like it kind of is always walking right up to the line of being this really edgy, provocative piece, and then immediately jumping five steps back because it's, you know, an American comfortable TV show.
Yeah, and so, there has to be a message and learning.
And yes, exactly.
And is it, Keanu Reeves in
Keanu
it?
Keanu Reeves is in it as her doctor. Okay, so he plays Dr. William Beckham, who is supposed to be this sort of renegade, completely throw the book out the window.
Read a book, more like
And he runs this kind of this inpatient service that she, this is the fifth one that she's finally going to try and cure her problems. And to be honest with you, I can't tell, having watched the 90-minute movie, one thing that he actually does to help her in any way at all. It seems to be he's just setting her up to have rock bottom, and that's going to cure her. And that's a long, grueling process to get through. It also ends with a very bizarre sequence. I mean, it lost me completely by the ending, with this sort of family connection that is just utterly bizarre and strange, and filmed in a way that almost makes it work, but really when you stop and think about it, it is absolute nonsense. So I do think it's a good movie for performances, and it is a bad movie for everything else.
Right, okay. Damned with faint praise there. Right, we'll move on to our third show of the day. This is Nadia's British Food Adventure. It's on Mondays 8:30 on BBC2. Here's a clip.
So I'm frying the garlic separately, and this is quite traditional in Bangladeshi cooking. It's a way of adding the garlic without it getting lost.
I love that sound.
Well, that reminds me of home. Fried garlic and shouting. My parents are very competitive cooks, so someone's always doing something wrong, and it's usually my dad. And you can hear the spices squeaking, and they're popping just very slightly. I'm going to throw that straight on top of the vegetables. So colourful and absolutely delicious.
Right, that's Nadia's British Food Adventure. And now, of course, James, people will know that she, presumably they'll know she was the winner of Bake Off, and she's just adorable.
She is. And I even sat down today while I was writing up my notes for this, and I watched, you know, the last 3 minutes of the 2015 Bake Off finale where she is named winner, and she gives this real rousing speech about how, you know, I'm never going to say no again, and I'm going to do it, I can. And it's actually really moving, and she's like bawling, and her children are bawling, and Mary Berry starts bawling, and I was bawling by the end of it as well. But so they additionally, in investing in Mel and Sue, the BBC have also latched on to Nadia, and I guess this is her first full series. She did one last year called The Chronicles of Nadia, where she went back to Bangladesh, where her family is originally from, and in this one it's going all around Britain. So I guess you would look at this is kind of like her real incubator series, because it's an 8-part one where she travels all across the UK to meet various producers of, you know, ingredients or processing or cooking processes or stuff like that. So in the first two episodes, she like picked asparagus in this bizarre contraption that she got into, going, this reminds me of childbirth. And that is exactly where you get her at her best. The less script they give her, and the more they let her sort of talk offhand and just be naturally charming, the better off this show is. Because she just has an X factor, a likability. And she's just there's a very interesting kind of role here, because you have this modern Muslim woman going around in her headscarf all the time, and yet she's incredibly attractive and warm and nice and just lovely, and it's just this really impossibly comfortable 30 minutes of TV, you know?
Stop being so nice! It's hard to dislike her.
It is hard to dislike her.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Great. Colin on Twitter says, just going back to the previous show we were talking about that has Keanu Reeves in it as a doctor. Colin says, I wouldn't cast Keanu Reeves in any more challenging role than a waiting room chair. That'll probably be the next TV series. James, thanks a million for coming into us. James Dempsey there. We're going to take a break after that. Has New York lost its soul?
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.